and welcome to The Hard Skills with me, Dr. Mira Brancu. Today we are talking about something every leader, actually every person, does constantly and usually gets it wrong, and it includes me, it includes you, okay? You know that moment when someone asks you for your input, your advice, your feedback, and then you willingly share your expertise, and then somehow it completely misses the mark. They tell you they tried it already or that it won't work. And you ask yourself, why did they ask my advice if they're not going to take it? Yeah, we've all been there. There's a reason for that. Today, we're diving into the concept of humble inquiry and how it can transform everything from performance conversations to organizational culture, to your normal conversations with your loved ones. So let me introduce our guest today, Peter Schein. Peter Schein is a consultant, author, and keynote speaker based in Menlo Park, California. Following a 30-year career in Silicon Valley, Peter teamed up with his father, renowned MIT professor Ed Schein, a foundational researcher of organizational behavior, group process consultation, and organizational culture, to start the Organizational Culture and Leadership Institute. Over 8 years together, Peter and Ed published 7 books and numerous papers on humble inquiry, organizational culture, careers, and humble leadership. Peter's work continues to follow his father's death, and in 2023, with the recent release of Humble Inquiry, 3rd edition. Yes, I have it. Peter has a bachelor's in social anthropology from Stanford and an MBA from Kellogg Northwestern. So I'm super excited to talk with him today. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much, Mira. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, I also should give a shout out to my supervisor, Dr. Stephen White, if you're listening. Thank you. Stephen White was my supervisor within the National Center for Organizational Development within the Department of Veterans Affairs. And he was the one that introduced me to humble inquiry, humble leadership, humble consulting, and the entire idea of process consultation. He trained me in that. That's how they train within the Department of Veterans Affairs Organizational Development Center. So, I really appreciated learning all of this, and the fact that here I am 5 years later talking to Peter Schein about this is super cool to be able to finally do that. So, Peter, you worked in Silicon Valley for 30 years, right? And then you decided to shift more into organizational culture and effectiveness and leadership with your father. And I'm curious, how did you get to that shift? What were some of the sort of like defining moments during that shift where either you had to learn or unlearn things in order to move in that direction from your 30-year career?
Yeah, that's a great question. But I guess in a way, I would say that, you know how we have jobs and we have professions, or we have things that we do and we have ways that we think. I don't think I was ever not thinking this way. Mm-hmm. I think I always had that perspective in my, marketing and business development jobs in Silicon Valley, in my corporate development jobs in Silicon Valley. Certainly, I did M&A work for Sun Microsystems for many years. And, we can think about M&A as successful if it's, financially accretive, or if, we gain a bunch of important intellectual property. We can also think of it as how well did we integrate a talented group of other people into our organization. I think as somebody who grew up, at my dad's dinner table, I was always thinking about, who are these people? What makes them tick? Are they going to fit in this, this division or this large organization? So I guess I feel like while I had many jobs in Silicon Valley, I was never far off from thinking about groups and group dynamics, and this is all stuff that came straight from my dad. You know, going back to majoring in anthropology, I could have done a bunch of things at Stanford, but that was the thing that was interesting to me. It happened to be at the same time that my older sister was doing her PhD in anthropology, so I was never far away from the family business.
It was in the water as you grew up. It
Yeah,
was
exactly.
always sounds like at the dinner table. I mean, I look at my own kids. They're 19 and 16, and they're like mini psychologists, and I'm like, don't go into psychology, but like they can't help themselves because that's how we raise them, right?
But you know, it's very interesting you bring that up because my dad was, I guess technically you would have called him a social psychologist. But given so much of his work at places like NTL, it really was more about groups and group behavior than it was about individuals and individual behavior. And so I came to that moment of truth at Stanford as an undergrad where I was quite connected to the psychology department. I did psychology experiments all the time, but I realized that that's not what was interesting to me. It was how groups figure stuff out, not how individual personalities, you know, end up getting expressed in different parts of work. So, yeah, that's that. I was, yeah,
And that
I picked that
resonates
up
for
from
me
him.
too. That resonates for me too. I did start out as a school counselor first, and that was a lot of group stuff. And then I went into clinical psychology mainly because I wanted to understand what I was seeing when when they were coming to me one-on-one with more significant or severe concerns, mental health issues. But because of my upbringing, as an immigrant and in an area of New York, especially being brought up in a highly diverse area, I was constantly curious about cultural factors, social factors, what led people to succeed in certain cultures and certain, situations versus others. And that turned into what leads people to succeed within organizations when you could take the same person in two different places and it doesn't work in one place and it does work in another. What are those sort of other factors? And that's a lot of group and organizational influences.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we struggle with, I think, in Silicon Valley is the sort of the icons and the charisma around certain famous leaders. And whether that's really what drives organizations or whether it's their effectiveness once they get going on things. And I often saw that balance between, you know, brilliant ideas that just are begged to be followed, or very effective teams that figure stuff out at the margin and create innovation that will change, you know, things. Or, you know, I worked at Apple, so we were changing the world all the time. But the other thing, though, about Silicon Valley that I want to mention, Mira, is that I wasn't that. And maybe it's because I was there a little bit before. I was there in the early days before there was infinite bandwidth, before there was infinite memory, before there was infinite storage. I was there in the sort of the constrained technology part of the, you know, innovation cycle. And so one thing I saw developing with was this idea of, you know, the whole mentality of move fast and break things. And I think that I didn't really agree with that. And I think that's partly because, you know, I grew up in a world where we have to figure out how to work together as a team. And if you're just always moving fast and breaking things, then you're breaking relationships as well. So it's one thing with software where you can, you know, do a dot release and fix it. But if you're breaking relationships with other human beings that you work with, because you know, tried something that was radical and other people violently disagreed with you. It's a sort of a disruption for the sake of disruption that I just didn't think was entirely right. So that was part of why I kind of got interested in doing stuff with my dad is we wanted to write about this. We wanted to rant about this a little bit. And that's what led to the Humble Leadership books. So,
So interesting.
yeah.
Yeah. So there was already something that didn't feel quite right in terms of how you felt
I
things
mean, it's me. I'm an older guy. There might be plenty of 38-year-olds out there who feel like I got it wrong. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
But I also feel like there are plenty of examples of super innovators in Silicon Valley who have recognized the importance of things like psychological safety and things like open and trusting relationships. And I believe in the end, those are the ones whose innovations stick. You can move fast and break things all the time, but if you can't build an organization that has open and trusting relationships, then you don't make it to the next innovation. You just
Yeah.
end up, people leaving and splitting off and doing that great work somewhere else. So.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you're preaching to the choir. So let's get into humble inquiry.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, if you don't mind, indulge me. I do want to read the definition of it because
Yeah.
my father and I probably spent, we found it pretty easy to write together, but I suspect we spent a lot of time on this little this little half page. So, we always wanted to characterize it as an art and as an attitude. And within that, of course, there's a skill set. But let's first talk about it as an art. Humble inquiry is the fine art of drawing someone out, of asking questions to which you do not already know the answer, of building a relationship based on curiosity and interest in another person. And I would add to that curiosity and interest in how we're doing as a group. Or how we're doing as a team. We have to be thinking about that context, not just ourselves or our relationship with one other person. So, and then the attitude part is humble inquiry is not just asking questions, it's a total attitude that includes listening more deeply to how others respond to our inquiry, responding empathetically, and revealing more of ourselves in the relationship building process. So it isn't just asking questions. It's asking questions that represent an attitude of curiosity and maybe are willing to betray our vulnerability a little bit. It's the part of the attitude is representing to other people that you embrace the fact that you don't know everything. And that the group knows more than you do. So how do you express that attitude?
Got it.
So that's the art and the attitude of humble inquiry.
We're reaching an ad break, but here's my initial thought. I was going to ask you, how you see this as different from a coaching mindset or attitude or a counseling mindset or attitude where you have some of the same elements, open-ended questions, active listening, but I think I've heard two things so far that might differentiate. So let me know if I got these right so far and if there's more. One is that it's focused on the team and drawing the team out and sort of like leveraging the information and knowledge, experiences of the group and appreciating that. And then the second was willing to betray vulnerability, which in a coaching or counseling relationship generally doesn't happen because the focus is only on the individual and not at all on the coach or consultant
Right.
or counselor. What do you think about that assessment?
I think that's great. I think you nailed it because, again, think about where this came from. This came from group dynamics more than individual psychology. So that's the first point. And then I think the second point is that we talk about humble inquiry as if it's I to you. But it's also you to me. It's a sharing process that we have to recognize. So as skillful as we might be at inquiry, We also have to be skillful at revealing a little bit about ourselves, because the end point is psychological safety, or the end point is openness and trust. And if we can't reveal a little, we might be great inquirers, but we also have to be good revealers.
Perfect. Beautiful. Love it. Okay. I have a million other questions, but we are reaching an ad break. So you are listening to The Hard Skills with me, Dr. Mira Branku, and our guest today, Dr. Peter Shine, author of Humble Inquiry and Humble Leadership. The Hard Skills is sponsored by TowerScope, my leadership and team development consulting firm. You can learn more about that at gotowerscope.com. The Hard Skills show live streams on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on LinkedIn, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, many other places through talkradio.nyc. If you are here right now at 5 p.m. Eastern on a Tuesday, you can join us and you can even ask questions directly of Peter Shine. So we will be right back in just a moment.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a high-achieving, growth-oriented leader? Are you interested in developing your authentic leadership while creating a healthy, inclusive workplace? Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Branku, host of The Hard Skills on talkradio.nyc at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, where we discuss how leaders develop the hard skills needed to make a greater impact. We interview experts, have live coaching, and tackle these challenges. Listen to The Hard Skills on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Welcome back to The Hard Skills with Peter Shine, our guest today. So, Peter, you described humble inquiry as an art and an attitude, the focus being on a group process, extracting the knowledge through curiosity, through shared vulnerability. And already, some leaders might be listening to this and they might say, sounds great. I don't have time for that. Can we go back to breaking things and moving fast? What would you say to that? Like, what, why would a leader want to slow down and put in that amount of effort into the work that they do?
Right. Well, you're sort of touching on what we tried to characterize from the very outset as the primary benefits of humble inquiry. And the first benefit is just purely information gathering, that there are tidbits of information in the other person, in the room, in the team, in the division, that if you're not out there trying to really figure out what's going on, not just the content of that makes decisions hard, but also the context that those decisions are going to be made in. I'm always feeling myself wanting to emphasize this idea of what's going on at the time, what's the context that we're trying to make hard decisions in. Now again, that seems like, Jesus, if I'm always just kind of poking around trying to figure out what's going on, I am going to not have time to spend, on the hard decisions and the hard information that I have to assimilate and filter and make decisions within. I get that, but I just sort of feel like, well, isn't it great then that we have generative AI to help us with the content? Because you, as a leader, you're the brilliant, intuitive, contextual human. Don't ignore that. Go out there and help other people help you figure out what's going on. Then the other benefit that we like to talk about is that humble inquiry is about relationship building. And if your relationships are all just information exchange, they're just, I'll tell you this if you'll tell me that, and everything is sort of transactionally based like that, you may find that there are situations where that works perfectly well. But you may also discover that you make incorrect decisions because there was more going on that your little transactional exchange bias didn't allow for. So the other framing that I like here, that I'm hearing more and more, I'm glad that I'm hearing this more and more, is people recognizing the distinction between certainty and clarity. That humble inquiry is about clarity, where you're assuming that more information is better, because if you're trying to understand with some clarity all of what's going on around you, you don't want to be blocking off certain sources of information or certain, disconfirmations. You should be wanting to assimilate as much context and content as you can. The problem with certainty is that part of that move fast and break things is that I want to quickly be able to eliminate something and quickly be able to emphasize something else so that I can be certain that this is the right path. Well, I mean, that works, but then there are times when that really doesn't work. And so our emphasis is on finding ways to be more inclusive and assimilative of information rather than getting on a particular track towards certainty and then recognizing halfway there that you're on the wrong track.
So, I heard information gathering, better decision making, greater clarity in times of uncertainty, not pretending that you are certain when in fact it's actually more complex. It's reminding me of a client that I was actually talking with today, and she was describing this leader who was really bullying. And the leader was just kind of like aiming at a certain level of certainty and clarity that wasn't available, and very angry that the information wasn't immediately and readily available when in fact it was highly nuanced and complex. But they were not interested in that. They were just sort of going at this person. And we were reflecting together about the downside of that stance is that leader is likely never going to have the full picture and all the information that could make them even more effective because people are too afraid to share anything because of that stance. So there's also like this, it's not just, for people to be more curious, it's also that psychological safety that you describe, that if you don't create that, people will not share with you what you need to be a better leader.
Exactly. And the unfortunately, there may be situations where driven inquiry, or what we in the book describe as diagnostic inquiry, that might actually, or even confrontive inquiry, another contrast, that might be successful. The problem is you haven't built a platform for the next time, the next tough decision you have. And so a lot of the point of humble inquiry is, I said relationship building, I'll rephrase that as building that substrate of openness and trust so that, when somebody else sees something down the road, they're going to tell you. They're going to answer questions that you didn't even know to ask because you built that platform of openness and trust.
Before we get to the relationship part, you mentioned di these different kinds of inquiries, diagnostic, confrontive. Can you share more about those? Like what are the differences? What do they look like? And when do you use one versus another?
And a lot of this was my father's work saying, if I'm going to talk about, and just the backdrop being that he wrote a book called Helping, and that was a lot of that was about doctor-patient relationships, but what came out of that was a chapter called Humble Inquiry. And I think what he realized is if I'm going to talk about this as this distinct thing, I better contrast it to other kinds of inquiry. So the contrasts are diagnostic inquiry, which is really about sort of specific problem-solving questions with a sort of an endpoint in sight. And so the positive side of this is that you may, well, with those guided questions, much in the way maybe an attorney or a doctor can use those questions, you get to that almost predetermined endpoint. So that can work. But you may also be completely on the wrong track, as we were talking about before. There's also confrontive inquiry where something's gone wrong and somebody's to blame, and the questions are really leading in that direction. Again, you've got some sort of predetermination. It doesn't have that open attitude of, I'm going to ask questions that I genuinely don't know the answer to. Instead, those diagnostic and confrontive forms of inquiry are really leading to an endpoint that, again, it may be the right endpoint, but it may not. And the point about humble inquiry is that it has that contextual flexibility or that resiliency in how you're interacting with the other person that allows something out of the box to enter into your decision frame. The other one I want to mention is what we call process inquiry, where it's different in that you're sort of embracing the fact you're taking a time out, you're taking a pause, and you're saying, let's talk about what's going on right now in this process. So you're sort of taking inquirer and informer and sort of saying, how are we doing together? And the point that's important about process inquiry is that it's a good way to kind of take a break. It's oftentimes, you especially with diagnostic or confrontive inquiry, you've got a line of inquiry that you are pursuing, and it's hard to sort of take your eye off that ball. The point of our process inquiry is to say, all right, let's stop. That's not working. How are we doing? Are we getting anywhere in with these kinds of questions and this sort of line of inquiry? Those are, different, contrasting kinds of inquiry. And the one thing we put in the book that I think people might find interesting, and in fact, we've suggested that you might even start with, there are little mini case studies in the appendix of the book that set up situations, and then we suggest what we think the responses could be. And then we try to identify, well, that sounds to us like a diagnostic inquiry response or set of questions, or a confrontive set of questions. And just starting to kind of internalize those differences. Wow, am I being overly diagnostic because I think I know the answer? Or am I being overly confrontive in my questions because I think I know who's to blame? It's all aware of being sort of mindful of what kinds of questions we're asking.
I was just going to say, yeah, they can all be useful, but you have to be really purposeful about why you choose one or the other. And most people are not.
Right.
And most people might aim to do more humble inquiry, but find themselves easily falling into the trap of diagnostic or confrontative and not also insufficiently focused on process inquiry as well. And
Yep.
so I did like those activities at the end because they were not easy and it's really good practice.
Well, and I will share that, and I think my father was probably in the same boat, but with Jamie, my wife, I'll say all the time, hey, just because I could write a book about this stuff doesn't mean I'm good at
It's so
it.
hard. Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you're in the moment and emotions are high and you're upset about something that happened, it's really hard. And there's only one way that you can do it better and better, and that's just a practice.
Yeah,
So
exactly.
we are reaching an ad break. So we're going to take a few moments. You're listening to The Hard Skills with me, Mira Branku, and our guest today, Peter Shine. And we will be right back in just a moment.
Misalignment within your sales team or with the client stalls deals and creates unnecessary friction for you and the client, resulting in up to 37% lower win rate. If you're in pre-sales, sales, sales management, or sales enablement, and you'd like to increase revenues, win rate, margins, client satisfaction, and stay competitive, this show is for you. Hi, I'm Art Fromm, host of the Making Seamless Sales Show. Please join me live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
Have you ever wondered what truly lies beneath the calm? I'm Jacinta Yang. Join me every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Talk Radio NYC as we explore healing, self-discovery, and a space where science meets spirits to help you find peace in a busy world. Take a deep breath and tune in to Beneath the Calm, where every conversation guides you back to the calm within.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to The Hard Skills with our guest today, Peter Shine. So let's loop back to relationships because you do have a framework about how to think about different levels of relationships. And I think when I think about that kind of like bully leader that I was talking with my client about, that is one kind of relationship. And we don't always realize how like in what stance would be ideal or optimal to move into this humble inquiry. So you have actually a great ladder for us to think about. I'd love for you to share a little bit more about it.
Yeah, sure. We were talking about being more sort of mindful or intentional in our inquiry. Our similar idea around relationships is that we be more mindful or intentional with our relationships. We have a tendency to say, well, I have a good relationship with so and so, or I don't have a great relationship with her, or I have a super good relationship with them. That's helpful, but you can be more specific in defining what kinds of relationships you have. And so a number of our books have this four-level model of relationships, and we have a tool that we refer to as relationship mapping that's described in the book so that you can really put this model to work. So let me talk you through the four levels. And I will go from level -1 to level 3, and I'll tell you why. The first level, arguably the least effective level, may be very efficient, but I don't think it's very effective, is level -1, which we refer to as domination or exploitation. This is where there's a clear power imbalance between one person and another, or one group and another group, and one's dominating or exploiting the other for the purposes of either a shared goal or maybe not a shared goal. But the point being, there's a power imbalance, and the person below just does not have any power relative to the person above, and that's the nature of relationship. Now, sometimes these aren't, you know, necessarily disruptive to the organization. They just may be sort of necessary evils, or they may be temporary. I had a Army general come up to me at a session that I was doing at the U.S. Air Force Academy, say that, wow, our relationships go from -1 to level 4. And I kind of laughed because, well, our model doesn't have a level 4, but he saw something in it that in his mind he created a level 4. He was referring to the process that goes from boot camp to, you know, Army Ranger, where you have a dominating relationship between the drill sergeant and you know, the lowest level of the organization in the Army. And then it goes on to levels of sort of what we call professional intimacy, as these teams come together and become much more effective. So that's level -1. Level 1 is, and I noticed that there isn't a level 0, because a level 0 would suggest there's no relationship at all. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about a different kind of relationship that's transactional. You've got defined roles, and you stay in your roles. You exchange information. I have described it as like an API, and it's a known API, and it's not flexible. You've got roles, and you just transact across those roles. That can be very, it certainly is very efficient, it can be effective, but our argument in this book, in many of our books, is that that kind of transactional relationship has limited effectiveness going forward. So the level 2 is a personal relationship where you accept the fact that you're a whole person, and somebody that you're working with or a team that you're working with are whole people, and it will be beneficial to the group to get to know more about each and every one of you, so that if there are issues that come up that have nothing to do with work but impact your effectiveness, at a certain point you need to have a close enough relationship, an open enough relationship, that you allow those things to come into the work environment. We know this happens. The question is, can we embrace it and be comfortable with it? And it's not always comfortable, and it always has to be, you know, culturally sensitive, right? All of us coming from different backgrounds may have different standards of what this kind of personal connection should be at work, but we have to strive to figure that out, because that level of openness and trust that develops as we become more personally intimate with each other, it's critical. It's critical to innovation. It's critical to creativity. It's critical to resiliency. Then our level 3 is intimacy. And in a way, what we're doing with level 3 is we're creating a contrast to what you would consider a productive personal relationship at work and an intimate personal relationship outside of work. Often we would think of this as a romantic relationship. What's come up as we've discussed this over the years is that oftentimes very effective teams will say, well, we're like a level 2.5. We really do know each other well enough to finish each other's sentences. But we're not crossing the line. We're not sort of awkwardly intimate with each other. Of course, we always get into a bright line around, romantic relationship or nepotistic relationships that shouldn't really be in the workplace, generally speaking. Though I did, I for one, and many other people I know did meet my wife at work, so it's something we all sort of figure out. But we wanted to create this four-level model so that we can be intentional and kind of deterministic as we think about what relationships we need in certain contexts at work. And generally speaking, our view would be you improve effectiveness, you increase effectiveness by taking transactional relationships and making them more personal.
And I'll kind of add when and this is especially for people who might do team development work, right? Team coaches, consultants, all of that. I like to think about how this applies to certain team models like Lencioni's five behaviors. So when you think about Lencioni's five behaviors, obviously you have what's at the bottom, trust. You have to have vulnerability and trusting relationships in order to engage in productive conflict. Where it becomes really interesting in terms of how your model fits really well and how I've helped explain this to other teams is when you get to accountability, which is before you get to results, you cannot reach the highest level shared results and goals without accountability. If you have level one accountability, it means all you have is your leader telling everybody, do this, do that. You're not doing this, you're not doing that. It's highly transactional. It doesn't feel good to the leader to have to do that to call people out. What you really want is level two accountability, which is helping relationships. And if you could translate the word accountability to we're helping each other be better, do better in order to together push each other to the highest levels, all of a sudden it feels better to people to say, hey, I feel like I'm the bottleneck here and I need help, or either asking for help or receiving help. Hey, I've noticed that things are getting stuck here with you. Is there something I could offer to help? That's a level two relationship. It's a helping relationship, right? So that's another way to just think about like you can apply it to all kinds of challenging, hard questions and discussion. So when we come back from the next break, I'd love to hear more about this feedback giving and receiving and how you had a really interesting way of talking about it in the book and when it's useful, when it's not useful, and how we think about humble inquiry and the feedback giving and receiving. So we are listening, you're listening to The Hard Skills with me, Dr. Mira Branku, and our guest today, Dr. Peter Shine, and we'll be right back in just a moment.
Thanks.
On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a purpose-driven individual looking for deeper healing, clarity, and growth? Welcome to the Expansion Room, a transformative space for purpose-driven individuals. I'm Siobhan Larice, host, licensed therapist, and coach. Join me every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Welcome
Welcome, welcome back to the Heart Skills. Okay, Peter, I can't believe this has gone by so fast. Let's see what we can squeeze in of all of the questions that I have for you. One of the things that where we left off is if I'm trying to be helpful, have a humble inquiry stance, trying to reach those higher levels of results, trying to stay in that level two relationship while I'm doing that, what are some pitfalls and some ways to think about giving and receiving feedback, whether it's performance feedback or like accountability feedback, peer-to-peer? I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think we need to touch on is the whole notion of advice. You brought it up earlier, but because I think our feelings about advice actually are very applicable to this, the notion of feedback as well, that somebody asks you for advice, what they're telling you is that there's something going on that is causing them to reach out for help. The advice that is being asked for, you know, my experience has been, and I think I shared this with my father, that so often somebody has a concern or needs help with something, and the question for advice, or the, you know, the framing of what advice is needed, is often kind of a safe space. So the person says, well, I need advice about this, when in fact what's going on is related but not the same, or much more, you know, existential than just that thing that's being asked for, that narrow advice that's being asked for. But it's safer for that person, or it's more comfortable to ask for that specific advice, even though what's going on is something much deeper. Mm. And the point about humble inquiry in this context is that, generally speaking, you probably know from reading this book that we know Michael Bungay Stanier pretty well, and his book, The Advice Trap, is a much richer resource on this idea. But the general point is that when somebody asks you for advice, you really need to know a lot more about what's going on before your advice. I mean, your advice might be useful, but the chances are you're going to miss something. Something else is going on. And so humble inquiry is about finding out what's really going on, rather than just plowing in with your expert opinion or your previous experience that would feed into advice that, again, you might hit it, but the chances are it's a swing and a miss, or they've already tried that, or and what that does is that undermines your credibility. And I would argue the same thing is true with feedback, you know, the difficult conversations. Because oftentimes, if your feedback is, wow, you know, you're fine in meetings, but you're pretty bad at spreadsheets, don't you want to know why? Don't you want to understand at a deeper level, well, what's going on? How can we together figure this out, rather than just sort of asking some confrontive or diagnostic questions and then sort of plowing into the feedback? There is more going on, you know, and maybe the issue is it's not performance, it's fit. But how are you going to get to that if you're too focused on the content as sort of, you know, characterized by the metrics that you're following to give that feedback, or the content that you've observed, rather than sort of knowing what's behind it? And so the humble inquiry questions, the curiosity, the interest in the other person enough to not just tell them what they're doing wrong, but trying to figure out what's really going on. We tell a story in the book about a captain of a aircraft carrier, 5,000 people, organization, just, you know, right there on that aircraft carrier. So this is a very senior medical or naval officer. You know, he's an admiral, but he's the commander in charge of a big ship. And something happens on the deck, which is basically sort of the lowest rung of the organization. And rather than just letting the hierarchy take care of an error, which it can do, this admiral, this captain of the ship, wanted to know what actually was going on. So he invited this lowest rung of the organization up to the bridge to have a conversation with him. And the point being, the feedback could have been given, right? The error was made, the feedback could have been given, the hierarchy can be very efficient at sort of resolving the issue and doling out the punishment if that was the case. But in this case, the admiral decided that it's far more better to figure out for building an effective organization to figure out what else was going on. Rather than just plowing in with the feedback, he said, I have more to gain for the organization by a few minutes to just figure out what else was happening at the time. So I hope that's what you were getting at, Mira.
And I think, you know, a couple of reflections I had are, you know, just think about, so first, one of the things that you mentioned, I think is, that I'm pulling out of this is, be careful not to focus on you when somebody asks for your feedback, right? They're asking about them.
Yeah.
And, it's so easy, depending on who you are and your personality, to fall into a trap of like, ooh, this feels so good. They want to know my expertise and they think that I know something, or if, you know, I'm a rescuer type or I'm a savior type and I'm the hero and I'm going to be the hero of this person's life because I'm going to give them the best feedback ever or whatever. But like, if you put yourself in the shoes of, you know, a time when you asked for feedback and someone gave you feedback based on their experiences instead of your experiences, it was very disappointing probably. Right. And you left, like you said, losing faith in that person's ability to help you instead of gaining faith in their ability to help you. So that's a lot of like what I'm pulling from you about how to think about the attitude and the art part of humble inquiry is to constantly be mindful of where is my focus going? Is it on me or is it on the other person in the group so that I could be more effective and we could be more effective?
Right, right. Yep. Yeah, is that feedback ultimately, even though are you giving them feedback by telling them something, or are you giving them feedback by inquiring about what's going on?
Exactly.
And so often the telling ends up, you know, my father had a post-it on his desk that said, telling turns me cold, asking warms me up. Just that framing, I think, is actually very helpful. That if you're spending too much time telling people, whether it's advice or feedback, some of it might land. But a lot of it just may just sort of go, you know, so that doesn't apply to me. And it leaves you feeling cold.
Yeah, yeah.
A number of questions that help you clarify what's going on for you, whether it's, again, whether it's advice or feedback, helps that questioning helps kind of warm you up.
Yes.
As you, but also collectively. The two of you, so you're workshopping something together.
Yep.
It's not, you know, being told something and then deciding whether or not to accept it.
Exactly. Yeah. One quick practical, you know, tip. I have learned to train myself when somebody asks for my feedback or input to first, or among the questions that I ask, you came to me I'm sure you're asking other people as well, what were you hoping I could offer that might be different or unique than anybody else you're asking? So that I could like better tailor what they're actually looking for that happens to be like from me. This is amazing. If people want to find out more about how to work with you and your work, I'm showing it on the screen right now for those who are going to be watching later or right now, but where can they find you if they're listening?
Well, you see that OCLI.org. Direct email to me is peter@OCLI.org. That's the most direct way.
Excellent.
And yeah, send me questions or thoughts and I'd love to hear from you.
Excellent. Excellent. And do get any of his books, including the newest one, the third edition, Humble Inquiry. It is really, 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 really good. Everybody, what did you take away? I know what I took away. More importantly, what is one small change you can implement this week based on what you learned from Peter? Share it with us on LinkedIn. We are both on LinkedIn, and we'd love to cheer you on and hear more about it. You can also share on talkradio.nyc on LinkedIn. The Hard Skills is also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Twitch, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, lots of other places. So you can find it anywhere you listen to your podcast. If today's episode resonated with you, share it with a colleague and leave a review. And thank you to talkradio.nyc for hosting. Together, we will navigate the complexities of leadership and emerge stronger on the other side. Thank you for joining me and Peter Shine today on this journey. I know that I was grateful to be able to talk with him, and I know that you probably learned a lot. This is Dr. Mira Branku signing off. Until next time, stay steady, stay present, and keep building those hard skills muscles. Take care, everybody.
Thank you very much, Mira.